In my book, Fast Food Ingredients Revealed, in the very back of the book, there is a chapter that talks about the research in terms of the relationship between the consumption of foods high in ultra-processed ingredients and a person's health over time. You know, what we generally call lifestyle diseases. So talking about things like heart disease, stroke, diabetes, fatty liver, all these kinds of diseases that we kind of attribute to the kind of lifestyle we're leading, you know, the kinds of foods we eat, you know, whether we get exercise or not, you know, how we take care of ourselves.
Welcome to the Plant-Based Curious Podcast, a place to explore and discover the plant-based and vegan lifestyle. Each week, we'll talk about our own stories and real discoveries, alongside our experts and experienced guests, about changing behaviors, whole food living, nutrition, and the amazing facts and positive curiosities about veganism. We're here for you as a guide and a place to gather resources. But with the simple click of our subscribe button, you're allowing yourself a little time and good energy to listen, laugh, and indulge in the lifestyle you may love. Please welcome your host, a certified holistic coach and plant-based lifestyle believer, Diane Randall.
Hello and welcome. Today we're diving into a fascinating topic, the world of fast food ingredients. We're joined by Mel Weinstein, a retired analytical chemist with a wealth of experience in examining industrial food ingredients and their impacts on human health. Mel's recent book, Fast Food Ingredients Revealed, What Are You Eating?, is a must read for anyone interested in understanding what's really in our fast food. Mel, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you a lot, Diane. I'm glad to be here and hope I can share some information which will be interesting to your listeners about food ingredients and additives.
I believe you will, because this show is for people who are curious about being plant-based. So maybe started eating plant-based, but they're thinking about it or they're already on the journey. So we have different spectrums of people. So this is a great conversation to have today to people who are still eating the standard American diet.
Yeah. And it applies to everyone. I mean, plant-based or not, people who eat commercial foods are going to really should need to know about the additives that are in their commercial products.
So you talk about additives, my software production career as a consultant. I've had to go into companies and work on production to really understand what the ingredients are, if it's a food company, to a finished product that they're making. So I don't know the details. So that's why I was excited to have you on here. But just so you know, I've had some exposure to food scientists and additives.
Sure. Yeah. Great.
So your book has opened many eyes to the number of additives in the U.S. food supply. Can you give us an overview of how extensive additives are in food?
Well, this will be a shocking piece of information, but nobody knows. There is an approximation that there are something like 9,000 to 10,000 additives that are approved for use in commercial foods. But I'll tell you right now, I mean, I've looked for it. I cannot find one single source on the internet where someone can go to find a complete listing of all of these additives, so they can look up the name, look up the properties, and get information about any additive that they're interested in. Now, you might say, there's got to be something out there. And yes, there are official and unofficial websites you can go to get information about additives. But as far as the federal government is concerned, everybody's heard of the FDA, Food and Drug Administration. That's the agency in approving, sort of approving, that's another whole subject there, but allowing additives into the U.S. food system. They have a site called Substances Added to Food, You could probably just type that in Google search and come up with the website. If you look at it, yeah, there's a lot of information there, but it covers less than 5,000 of the additives that are conceivable for the commercial food system. Now, one could make the case that of the 9 to 10,000 additives, probably a lot of them are not even used anymore. Food manufacturers have decided that either they found something better or there's just no need to use those additives anymore. So they're really not something to be concerned about. So I'm just speculating here. Maybe the ones that are listed at the Substances Added to Food website, maybe that those are just the ones that are presently.
Yeah, like
in
they've
the
updated the list, maybe.
Maybe, but I looked through the website. I didn't see anything that said, hey, this is just what's in the system now, and we've eliminated everything that's not necessary.
Oh, that's quite alarming.
I think so. I mean, as a citizen, we should be able to readily get this information. In Europe, for example, they have what's called the E-number system, and every single substance there has an E-number. And so anybody in Europe, no matter what country you are in Europe, can look this up online. And that's supposed to include every single substance.
Wow. So in your book, you talk about GRAS ingredients. Could you explain to our listeners, what are these? What are GRAS ingredients?
Yeah. You grass. Say grass, I say
well,
broth.
And we're both from sure. And we're both exactly. From Illinois, so what do you say? You say yeah. Grass.
It's okay. Said different ways. There's okay. No official way. It's an acronym. It stands for Generally Recognized as Safe. And that acronym came along around 1958, and it was at a time when a number of Americans started to get concerned about the chemicals that were being added to foods. Because after World War II, there was this huge boom in food science and food research and the commercialization of foods that were made from synthesized chemicals. And so the concern was, by the public, essentially, can we trust the foods that are being manufactured with these chemicals that didn't exist in the past? Some of them existed before World War II, of course, but if you go back to the 1800s, very few of them were being used. So all of a sudden in the 20th century, there was hundreds and thousands of new ingredients that didn't exist. So in 1958, the government tasked the FDA to start tracking these chemicals. And the FDA thought, heck, there's thousands of these things. This is going to take forever. It's going to take a lot of money. It's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of manpower. It's going to take forever to get a hold, get a handle on this information. So what they decided to do was they created an initial list of additives that had been used for dozens, if not hundreds of years. And they said, okay, these ingredients or additives, they seem to be safe because they had this long track record and people weren't keeling over dead from eating foods that had these ingredients. So they said, okay, we'll make this list and we'll say that these chemicals and substances are generally recognized as safe. So they put together this list. I think there was, if I'm remembering right, maybe 1,200 or so substances that met that definition. So then they started from there. Now, it got complicated, however, because then the FDA realized that with all the new additives being discovered and being added to foods, that they didn't have the manpower and the money, et cetera, to evaluate each ingredient in their agency. In other words, they'd have to have a huge staff of chemists and food scientists, etc., in order to do the studies to determine the safety levels of these ingredients. So then they made the decision, well, we're not going to be able to do this. So we're going to put the burden of proving that these ingredients are safe for consumption, put the burden on the manufacturers. All right. So essentially they handed it to the manufacturer and saying, okay, if you think this is safe and you think it should be in the food supply and it serves a useful function, you're going to have to prove it to us.
Wow.
So there was an application process. Now, there were several ways for manufacturers to do this, which I'm not going to go over because it'll just take too much time. But one of the ways was, okay, you can do all of the research. You can do it yourself, or you can hire a laboratory or a consultant to do it. And you can submit it to us under the GRAS title, under the GRAS description.
Okay.
Okay. So it's a new additive, but now it's getting this generally recognized. Then the FDA, their people would get all this information. I mean, it could be hundreds of pages of information, and you can actually go online and look up any ingredient, any additive you want, and see the document that was submitted to the FDA. So the FDA goes through it. They look at the research. They determine whether the research was good and complete, whether this additive is going to be safe for the American people to consume in their food products. And then they give it a kind of check mark. It's not an official approval, but it said you've met all the requirements that we've asked for as far as submission for approval, and we'll go ahead and give it the okay. Now, they could go the other way and say, hey, you're missing this information, or we don't believe the data you've presented us, and they could send it back to the manufacturer, who can then decide whether to continue with the process, which is pretty expensive. It's not a simple thing to do. Okay, so that's the bigger GRAS picture, or GRAS picture. Now I'm saying GRAS. So there was, it doesn't take much to turn me. So you had the original list, which had roughly 1,200. Now you have this bigger list that keeps growing every year with dozens of new additives being added. And that, for manufacturers, is the cheapest route to go. All right, so that's why they choose to do that. That's a long answer, probably,
but
to a short
question.
But it's okay.
Did they track the impact to health on the public with the ingredients?
Yes. I mean, again, that was up to the manufacturers to either do the work themselves or hire the right consultants to do the studies to determine the safety level. And it was based upon which foods this additive was going to be used in and at what levels, what percentages or parts per million or whatever unit you want to look at.
That is just alarming and interesting at the same time.
And that's the short version.
So shifting to the fast food industry, do these chains use the same additives as what we see in commercial food products? I know you talked about Pizza Hut, McDonald's, and I think there was another one in your book, these three fast food chains. Taco Bell, yes, yes.
Yeah, Taco Bell was the third one.
Yeah, do they use the same additives?
Are they the same? Back in 2016, I started my podcast, which is Food Labels Revealed, and I just looked at foods that were on grocery store shelves, or maybe in big box stores, you know, like Walmart or convenience stores. And so for a number of years, that's what I paid attention to. But then in my mind popped up the question, okay, we've got a whole nother area of commercial foods that I haven't really talked about on my podcast, and it was fast foods. So I started looking at several fast foods, and I created episodes on certain ones, and that question kept popping up in my mind. So I decided to do a deep dive into that subject. And I found only a fraction, small fraction, of all of the fast food restaurants in the United States actually provides that information, the ingredients in their products. And initially, I think I looked at maybe 25 or 30 fast food restaurants online and found, oh, maybe 10. So it was a small fraction, so a minority of fast food restaurants were actually telling consumers what was in their fast food. So from there, I thought, oh, wait a second, this sounds like it could be a subject I can really get into and maybe ultimately write a book about it.
Interesting.
And so I looked online to see if anybody had written a book on the ingredients in fast foods. And there were all kinds of books on fast foods. I mean, you name it, how people get hooked on fast foods, what were the origins of fast foods, the history, the founders. I mean, lots of information. But there was no single book that actually addressed the subject of the ingredients. And so, okay, I'm on my way. So I spent a couple of years researching the subject. And I decided that for my book, which is called Fast Food Ingredients Revealed, What Are You Eating? I selected those three restaurants you mentioned, McDonald's, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, for several reasons. The obvious reason was they did list the ingredients in most of the items on their menus. So I had the information, I had the data I could look into. And then the other reason was, well, they're some of the most popular fast foods in America. And they covered kind of three different cuisines. You had McDonald's for American food. You had Pizza Hut for Italian food and Taco Bell, of course, for Mexican food. So it kind of covered the terrain. So I thought they were good choices.
Wow. What about the disclosure of nutritional and ingredient information for restaurants? Did they have the same rules as fast food?
Okay, well, let me go back to your earlier question. I did ultimately find that the vast majority of additives in fast foods were the same ones that you find in grocery stores. Okay. Go ahead and repeat your question. I just lost it.
I said, we're talking about restaurants. Did they have to abide by the same disclosure of nutritional information and also ingredients, reporting that to the public? They did.
Yeah, that's a very good, comprehensive question. The answer is it depends.
Okay.
If you're going to your local favorite Mexican restaurant, let's say, in the town that you're living in, and they're kind of a one-off restaurant, or maybe they just have a couple of stores in the area, the answer to the nutrition question is no, they don't. The magic number is 20. That's set by the FDA, that if you have 20 stores in a chain and all those stores are offering the same menu to their customers, then yes, they are required to let customers know about the nutrition facts label, essentially the same thing that you find on store packages. So they have to reveal that information. Now, you may not see it when you walk into the store. It may not be plastered up on a wall, but if you ask the manager, can I see the nutritional information for one of your products? They have to provide that. Also, alternatively, you could go to the website of that fast food chain. And somewhere in that website, they're going to have to reveal that information about all the foods on their menu. Now, remember, it's not going to work at your local restaurant unless your local restaurant is very enlightened and really wants to share that information with their customers.
Okay.
So turning the page and now talking about ingredients, what are the requirements for restaurants revealing the ingredients in their foods? There are none. Unless there's something at the state level or at the city municipal level, and I'm not aware of any of those, there is no requirement. Okay. So when I said that I found this information for McDonald's and Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, those restaurants were doing that voluntarily. They were not required to do that.
So it sounds like And I know I do this now, food, if I'm interested, and I'll call someone and ask the waiter or waitress and ask, what's exactly in this food? And sometimes they don't even know, and they have to go ask the chef.
Right. Yeah, there's two things you don't want to confuse. You don't want to confuse components versus ingredients.
Oh, gotcha.
You know, so if you're ordering a hamburger at a restaurant and you ask the waiter or waitress, I said, what's in this hamburger? Well, they may say, we've got this bun, we've got this patty, we've got this cheese, lettuce, pickles, special sauce. You know, those are the components. They're not going to tell you. Chances are they're not going to know.
Oh, really? They're not going to know if there's an additive. They won't know that.
Yeah, it'll be the components. The additives are what are inside the components.
Oh, gotcha. So they won't even know that.
Yeah, like pickles. Pickles, for example. You might think pickles, that's a pretty product, but there could be 10, 12 actual ingredients in the pickles.
Really? That is so interesting. I thought I'm looking at this pickle, which with my own eyes, and I see a pickle. I don't see anything else, and I see the pickle juice maybe. Wow.
Yep. Well, it's a lot more involved. And I can give you an example of that later, you know, if you want to go into a little bit of detail.
Yeah, because even plant-based food that's been processed like a black bean burger or something, I won't ever look at it the same way.
They got plant-based commercial foods have the same issues. They don't get an automatic health halo on them just because they're plant-based. Yeah.
You discussed a term in your book, you discussed the term processed. Can you elaborate on why this term is problematic?
Yeah, to me, the word process has very little meaning, although you'll hear all kinds of people with all kinds of backgrounds and in all kinds of professions talk. Mention that word process as if it has some kind of exact meaning, and it doesn't. It's a generic word. And so let's just look at a particular example. Let's take a potato, okay? Most people know potatoes grow underground, right? And so they're dug up. And usually they're not taken straight to the grocery store for sale. Most of the time, the dirt is going to be removed from the potato so it doesn't look like a dirty vegetable, right? So soon as you take that potato and you wash the dirt off, well, what have you done? You have put it through a processing step, right? And so the word process can just apply to a dirty potato that's made to look presentable to a consumer in a grocery store, all right? But we know there's all kinds of other things that can be done to that potato. So you could take that potato and you can take the skin off of the potato. That's another processing step. Then you can slice that potato. Let's say you slice it into very thin slices. That's another processing step. Then you can take those slices, you can add some seasoning to them. It could be something just as simple as salt, right? And then you drop them into this vat of very hot oil, right? You're making French fries, all right? So there's another processing step, the seasoning, and then there's the frying. And that's a big one, okay? And we'll get back to that in a moment. So now you've got potato chips, and again, if you want to put some additional seasoning on them, like cheese seasoning or something, that's a processing step. And then we haven't even got for the bad stuff yet, really. I mean, some people might argue that deep frying isn't very good for you, and that's usually true. You don't want to eat a lot of those kinds of foods. But then, if you're a manufacturer, you want to put those potato chips in a bag, right? Seal up the bag, ship them to a distributor. Distributor ships them out to various stores around the country, and they wind up on a shelf somewhere. Okay, well, in order for the manufacturer to put a product on the shelf that they know it's going to last a long time, it's going to be consistent in appearance and taste and odor and mouthfeel and all those properties, they've got to put additives in there. They got to put preservatives in there. They got to put chemicals that are going to maintain that taste and odor and general appearance. And so now you're getting to something that's even more processed. Okay, so how many steps have I talked about so far? I have no idea. Okay, but each is a step in processing. So when you use the word processed food, you should ask the question, what are you talking about? Are you talking about something that's slightly processed, like cleaning off a potato, getting the dirt off of it, all the way up to something which is extremely processed, okay? So in my book, I talk about the different categories of non-processed or slightly processed. I tend to lump those two together, to moderately processed, to highly processed, to extremely processed, okay? So when you say the word process to me, that's what I'm going to ask you. What kind of processing are you talking about? Now, some of the additives that wind up in foods are synthetic. Okay. In other words, they don't exist in nature. They're made. Well, I take that back. They may exist in nature, but they come in a natural form or a synthetic form. And then there are chemicals that never existed in nature and just strictly synthetic. I mean, just think of all the artificial sweeteners that you may have tried. So these are what I call automatically or extremely processed. They automatically go into that category. And if you've got enough of these kinds of ingredients in a commercial food, then a lot of people describe those foods as ultra-processed. Okay, so if you see the word ultra-processed, that's what they're talking about. And ultra-processed foods are essentially, this is the way I look at them, they're essentially foods that are recognizable from their original source. So if you take that potato and you hold it up against a bag of chips, you take the chips out of the bag and you hold them up to the potato, they don't look anything alike. If I just showed you the chips, you wouldn't necessarily think potatoes. I mean, chips can be made from corn, can be made from various ingredients. So an ultra-processed food is something that generally does not look anything like it originally came from.
Absolutely. And I see that a lot. I mean, I think I see that more now than ever with different products. And I could also share when I would work at these food companies, and I'm thinking, for example, looking at the tuna, for example, brand of tuna, I'm just not going to name it. But I see the fish come off the Atlantic Ocean through the pipes. And then we get all the way down. There are several processes. And then, Mel, there's a big vat machine and you have all these bags lined up with all these ingredients that go in for different reasons.
Ah, you've seen it firsthand.
I've seen it many times. And here's the thing. Even when I wasn't plant-based, I would say, okay, I'm not going to eat that anymore. I see a lot of processes, a lot. And I do see it firsthand, and that it's educated me in a different way.
Yeah. And when it comes to animal foods, they have their own separate set of processes that they go through that are very different, can be very different.
They can be very different. And I cannot bear to work there because even animal, you know, how many pounds of hoofs, how many pounds of I haven't been brave enough to deal with that kind of process. So usually I back out of those kind of assignments. So in your research, particularly with McDonald's, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, you've uncovered some surprising ingredients. Can you give us a few examples?
So McDonald's, I'm not sure today if they're selling this or not because they change up their menus over time. But when I was researching the book, they had on their menu what was called the Southwest Buttermilk Crispy Chicken Salad.
Oh, I haven't been to McDonald's in probably 40 years.
Never mind. Maybe some of your listeners. Okay. So in this salad, they had shredded cheese. And one of the ingredients in the shredded cheese is called natamycin. It's N-A-T-A-M-Y-C-I-N. Now, if you're familiar with drugs at all, you might recognize the suffix or the ending of that name, natamycin. Does that ring a bell at all?
Yes, that does.
Erythromycin, like erythromycin is an antibiotic. Okay, so natamycin is another type of antibiotic, and it serves as a preservative in the food. And when I came across this, I had no idea that antibiotics were actually food ingredients. And they're in there because they're fighting bacteria, right? If there's any bacteria in the food, you don't want that bacteria to grow. You don't want to survive and cause issues within that food. Health issues, it may cause off flavors, off odors, or whatever to develop. So this natamycin was in the cheese for that purpose. And this natamycin, you may recognize the source of it. It's from a strep bacterium in the soil. So it's a streptococcus material, and it inhibits essentially mold formation as well. So that was an odd one. And I thought, well, maybe this is very unusual. And so there's another website I go to at that the FDA has. And it's a website that shows you all the new applications for food additives. And so you go to this website and you see dozens and dozens and dozens of new substances that manufacturers are requesting to be added to the food supply. And if you look at a recent list, you'll see that more and more of these soon-to-be new additives are biological in nature. Okay, not chemical. Some of them are chemical still, yes, but a lot of them, more and more, are microbiological. And so that's, most people probably don't realize that, but that's what's happening. The more and more functional uses are being found for microbial additives in foods. Okay, so that's one. Do you want to hear any more?
Yeah, let's talk about one more.
Weird ingredients?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, let me find a good one here. This is an additive. Okay, it's called trehalose, found in Taco Bell's refried beans. Okay, and this is an ingredient I had never heard of. Okay, so this is a first for me. It's actually a natural product that was first discovered in 1859. So it's pretty old. And it was found in rye fungus, the rye plant. I mean, you can make a rye flour from. It was found in a fungus growing on the rye. It wasn't a big deal back in the middle 1800s. I mean, they weren't making a lot of food products with additives in them back then. So it wasn't until it was found later, and I think in the 1900s, it was found to exist in the cocoons of a insect. And the insect is called the Larinus maculate beetle. And it was found in Turkey. That's where the insects live. And what was discovered after it was chemically analyzed was that this material, trehalose, is a type of sugar. Okay. It's not as sweet as table sugar. It's 45% as sweet. And since that time, it's been found in other insects as well. And it serves a very important function, both in insects and in plants, in that it keeps the plant or the insect from dehydrating or drying out. So if there is a drought in the area where this insect or plant lives, it can survive. It can survive months without water. There's a plant called the resurrection plant.
Yeah.
You can kind of tell by the name, resurrection plant. I mean, okay, so it's living in a very dry and hot climate. It gets very little rain. It has this trehalose in it, which kind of acts like a special blood sugar and keeps that plant from drying out to the point where it dies. So it can live for months in that kind of environment. And then when the rains come, finally, it kind of resurrects and begins to look like a regular plant again. like I said, it's present in insects. It's present in some plants. I have no idea why it's in the refried beans in Taco Bell.
I love refried beans.
Oh, I do too.
I never would have dreamed that you would need anything in refried beans, you know?
I mean, usually I can figure out why a particular additive is in a food. In this case, I researched and researched. I could not find any reason for its presence.
Well, Mel, you have really given us so much insight into these additives and ingredients. And if you think about it, if you think about your career and things that you've learned, Mel, what would you say are the consequences of consuming these fast foods? If you could just be honest about that right now, your opinion.
Yeah. Well, in my book, Fast Food Ingredients Revealed, in the very back of the book, there is a chapter that talks about the research in terms of the relationship between the consumption of foods high in ultra processed ingredients and a person's health over time. What we generally call lifestyle diseases. So talking about things like stroke, diabetes, fatty liver, all these kinds of diseases that we kind of attribute to the kind of lifestyle we're leading, the kinds of foods we eat, whether we get exercise or not, how we take care of ourselves. And so I started digging around as I was writing this book to see what kind of studies were being done. And I was surprised. There's quite a few. And in my book, I kind of pick the 10 that I thought were most interesting and fairly current, like within the last 10 years. And it turns out that there are some massive studies that involve tens of thousands, even over 100,000 people who are being studied over a long period of time, maybe upwards of 10 years. And these are called correlation studies. They're getting to the cause. What is it about the ultra-processed foods that are making people sick? But they're developing an association. And generally what they find in each of these studies is that the larger the percentage of ultra-processed foods in a person's diet, the higher the risk they are for significant lifestyle diseases, whether it's cancer, heart disease, or whatever. So the data is out there, okay, showing that we're not just making an assumption here. And I've heard most of my life, the more fast food you eat, worse it is for your health. And there wasn't really the science to back it up, but now there is. You might have heard of that fellow by the name of Spurlock. This is back in the 90s or early 2000s.
Yes.
Who tried to get by just eating McDonald's food. And he wrote a book. They made a movie out of it.
He got overweight.
And, you know, he got pretty thick. Yeah.
Well, if we look at the health statistics of the country, we can see that something in our food is making us sick. I'm not a scientist, so why I'm saying something. Yeah. Some of the ultra-processed foods are making us sick because we have no idea what these additives and ingredients are. And you've given us so much insight. It's more so than I could have ever imagined.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of culprits in our society and fast food eating or just eating highly, extremely processed foods in general is a big culprit as to why there's more diabetes, obesity, organ diseases in our bodies occurring at much earlier ages than they used to and in much larger numbers.
Yes, but you know what? It's just we have to be our own advocate. We can wait on other people to tell us exactly what we need to do. So we have to educate ourselves so that and talk about these conversations like you and I are doing to educate people on how to, you know, advocate for yourself and really know and not trust anyone about what you put in your body. I mean, we all decide what we're going to eat and we really don't want people telling us what to eat. So I always tell people, just read the ingredients. Okay. Understand what you're putting into your body. That way you're making a clear choice.
Right. No, that's a very good advice. We have to be our own steward when it comes to the food we eat. And we have to, as you said, educate ourselves little by little. I mean, it's a lot of information, but if you start looking into it.
Little by little, it's a process. It is literally one meal, one day.
You're in the grocery store. Pick up the box. Just don't look at the front cover to see what the manufacturer is telling you is great about this food. Turn that box over on the side panel where all the nutrition information is and learn how to read that nutrition facts label to get the right information you need. And then start looking at that ingredient list and begin to question what's in that product. Is it something you should be eating or not?
I have one more question along that line. You talk about two essential front of package labels needed. One is the nutrition score and two, degree of processing. Why is the United States way behind in other countries in this area? And how can our smartphones help us?
Because we are. Yeah. It's not something that our government has put a priority on. Now, I have to change that up a little bit. Just within the last 2 years, the FDA and associated agencies are looking into that question. Okay. But long before our government started looking into it, other governments around the world started looking at it. And if you're in Europe and you pick up a food package in a grocery store, chances are you're going to see on the very front of that package a little box, whatever, that gives you a score. It might be a number. It might say be 1 to 5. It might be a color code, but it's something that's going to tell you what the nutritional value of that product is. So instead of having to turn the box over and look carefully at the nutrition label and stand in the grocery store for 5 minutes trying to figure that out, you have this very simple code. The score you can look at on the front of the box and in a matter of seconds say, oh, I don't like the nutritional score on this product. I'm not going to buy it. The score is too low. Might be the other way around. Hey, this has a good score. I can have some confidence that this isn't going to be a problem for my health in the long run. Now, I wish I could say the same thing about a score for processed food. And I like to use the word manufactured instead of processed. Fortunately, it's very rare that you will find that information. And the other part about that, I mentioned other countries are way ahead of the United States, but almost all of those scores are not required. There's no law mandating that they be put on the boxes. So it's still kind of a voluntary system, but at least they have a system. Whereas in this country right now, we have nothing actually that we can turn to. So those are the two things in an ideal society and a great future. Hopefully before I kick the bucket, I will be able to go into a store, pick up a box of cereal. And on the front of that cereal, it'll tell me about the nutritional quality of it. And it'll tell me also about the degree of processing or manufacturing. And of course, the higher the degree of manufacturing, the worse the food is because of what I just said earlier about the scientific studies that are making that association. So that's the ideal world of the future. I hope we're headed there. It'll make things a lot easier for consumers to, instead of taking a food science class or a chemistry class, getting a degree, all they got to do is look at the front of the package and be somewhat assured that they're making a good decision for themselves.
Well, just thankful to you for writing that book.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, go right ahead.
And this is something I'm talking about in my recent episodes on my podcast, Food Labels Revealed. But there are several apps that are available on smartphones now. There are four of them that I've looked at. The one I recommend the most, it's the easiest to use, very comprehensive, is called Yuka, Y-U-K-A. I don't know what that means, but it's yuca, Y-U-K-A. And it gives both Nutri-scores telling you about the nutrition of the food, and it also gives you the ingredients. And it has a camera function on it. You just hold the camera up to the, whatever that code's called. Okay. You just hold it up to that price tag, and it'll read it. And if it's in their system, most likely it is, it will pop up all this information for you about that product. And you can do it while you're standing there in the grocery store.
Oh my God, I love that. I'm going to download that today.
Yeah. So these apps are way ahead of our government. Another one, this is like the Wikipedia of food ingredients and food additives. It's called Open Food Facts. Open Food Facts. And it's like Wikipedia in that you could upload your own information to this app. If you find a product that's not already in the app and you want to contribute to the data, there's a way to put that information into the app so other people can use it. And then it also gives you the nutrition score and the degree of processing or manufacturing. Third one is just called INGREED for short. It's short for ingredients. So it's INGRED. And it also has these E numbers that I mentioned before that are used in Europe. And it also covers cosmetics, and it notes the ingredients as well. The next one I'll mention is by the Environmental Working Group, EWG for short. It's called Healthy Living, and it highlights ingredients, both, again, the nutrition and the processing aspects of it. And it also displays nutrition facts labels exactly as you would see them on the label.
Well, I'm feeling better about our conversation now.
There's a way to defend yourself.
Yes, there's a way to advocate for myself. I can use these apps, and the listeners, you guys can use this app to process all this information Sure. You and I've been discussing. So, Mel, I want to thank you for sharing such vital information with us. Your insights are invaluable in helping us make better food choices. And a big thank you to our listeners for joining us on the Plant-Based Curious podcast. Remember to visit our website for more information and resources, and tune in every other Sunday for new episodes. Stay curious and healthy, everyone. See you next time.
Thank you for joining us on the Plant-Based Curious podcast. We really hope you've enjoyed our discoveries, experiences, and resources about the plant-based vegan lifestyle. Remember to click that subscribe button so you can join in on our future conversations. Until next time, allow yourself a little time and good energy. Thank you for joining us on the Plant-Based Curious podcast. We really hope you've enjoyed our discoveries, experiences, and resources about the plant-based vegan lifestyle. Remember to click that subscribe button so you can join in on our future conversations. Until next time, allow yourself a little time and good energy.